The drumming was steady and regular, echoing all around the hollow, seeming to come from all sides at once. The sulfurous smoke of the many fires drifted around on a light eddying breeze. In the center of the natural amphitheater, a bonfire blazed, only a few yards from the stream bank. High flames licked from rough-hewn logs, and people danced around them in time with the throbbing drumbeat. There seemed to be an equal number of men and women, most of them naked but for knotted loincloths. Sweat glistened on their bare flesh. Their bodies jerked in rhythm to the drums, as though the measured beats inflicted muscular convulsions. Numerous goat-masked figures danced near the outer ring of fires, leaping and spinning like dervishes. The people who sat around Kane and Grant moved their shoulders with the drumbeats. Gourds were dipped into a trough-like, hollowed-out log filled with a greenish liquid. The congregation sipped from the gourds, shuddered, and passed them along. Grant and Kane abstained, but they found themselves unpleasantly affected by the ceaseless cadence.
I saw a ceremony like this once in a triple poor outland settlement. Everybody dancing to bring rain. Gets into your bones after a while.
Where's Esther? I thought she was running this show.
As if on cue, the onlookers at the edge of the hollow parted, and a naked girl leaped nearly into the fire. It took both men a moment to recognize Esther. Her long dreadlocks were bound up in a multicolored scarf, and her body was painted bright yellow with bands of red over her breasts, back, and belly. In her right hand, she held a yellowed human skull. In her left, she whirled the silver crucifix by its thong. As if by its own accord, her slender body responded to the rhythm of the drums, propelling her around the edge of the bonfire in a jittery, jerky, arm-flailing dance. Her eyes appeared to be closed, but somehow she managed to skirt the flickering flames. She danced through the billowing clouds of smoke, through showers of embers. Esther circled the fire, then around the perimeter, whirling the cross over her head. The other dancers joined in, and Esther threaded her way among them, now and then facing one of the men, placing the skull between her thighs. The man would bend and bestow a kiss upon it. Kane watched, trying to fathom as much meaning out of the ceremony as he could. Esther twirled madly on the balls of her feet. Sweat pebbled her flat-muscled body where it wasn't covered by paint. Her pirouettes brought her closer and closer to where Kane and Grant sat on the ground. She came to a sudden stop before them. Stooping down, Esther opened her eyes. They gleamed with a wild, deranged light, and her lips peeled back from her teeth in a grin. Both Grant and Kane felt an inward cringing at the grin. It was demented, mocking, and superior all at the same time. Mama Esther raised the skull to her lips, pressing them against a small hole bored in the rear of the cranium. She took a deep breath and exhaled into the hole. Whitish-gray powder, like ash, pulverized to the consistency of dust, puffed out of the eye sockets in a cloud. It settled on the two men's faces. They fought to keep from sneezing. Kane began to flick dust from his eyelashes when he experienced the bizarre sensation of ghostly fingers caressing his mind, as if they were probing something hidden, something valuable.
Now, you will be cleansed and reborn.
Kane and Grant allowed themselves to be gently lifted to their feet by a pair of masked men and guided to the bank of the stream. Esther capered before them, whirling her crucifix. All of Kane's instincts yelled at him, but it was as if his mind were shrouded in several layers of thick, soft velvet. The two men were led down the bank and into the warm, shallow waters. Mama Esther left the skull and the cross on the ground, and standing hip-deep in the stream, she lifted both hands, palms outward. A goat-masked man slashed the edge of a curve-bladed knife across the flats of her hands, two bisecting strokes for each one. Superficial cuts in the shapes of crosses oozed bright red blood. The man clasped Grant's and Kane's left wrists and deftly cut the same cross into the palms of their hands. Kane felt no pain whatsoever, not even dismay, when he saw scarlet drops dropping into the brackish water. Moving between the two men, the Hungan clutched their hands tightly, squeezing so that trickles of intermingled blood streamed down their wrists and forearms and fell into the stream. They spread out in dark, wavering patterns. Mama Esther continued squeezing their hands as if they were sponges, until muscles stood out in stark relief on her slender arms, and her entire upper body trembled with the exertion. Then she relaxed her grip. Still holding their hands, she pressed them gently to lay down in the stream, immersing their bodies in the water. Somehow, Kane understood the act was a symbolic drowning. When they were hauled back up, soaking wet, Mama Esther drank a mouthful of water, then spit it directly into their faces. Their hands were bandaged with strips of gauze that smelled strongly of unguent.
You have been baptized in the name of Saint Jean. You are now purified, and we must get on with what must be done.
Wiping at the muddy mixture of ash and water on his face, Grant blinked at her.
Which is?
Salvation or damnation. Both will carry a heavy price.
It seemed to Bridget as if she and DeFore had fought for days against the rats. Her arms became leaden with the ceaseless flailing against the fur-covered bodies. Her upper body was bleeding from a score of tiny claw-inflicted wounds, but so far none of the rats had bitten either of them.
I can't keep it up much longer!
The bodies of dead rats lay in heaps at the bottom of the pit. The few that she and Bridget hadn't killed feasted on the corpses, chewing their way through the soft underbellies. The ceaseless whipping of her arms lagged, and a brown furry beast darted up DeFore's body toward her face and throat. DeFore seized it in her fists and beat at the others with it, using it as a bludgeon. The captured rats squeaked and squealed, and the other rodents drew back, scrabbling just out of reach. They chittered in fear.
Maggie, keep squealing.
DeFore did, and while the rat shrilled in fright and pain, the others held back.
It won't last long!
No, and there's no way out. Unless Kane and Grant come.
We have to get out of this ourselves! Oh!
Bridget said nothing, feeling a sickening despair fill her. At least the Swampy had stopped dropping rats on them from above. Already, the truce of fright seemed to be ending, and the rats were scuttling back over the bodies of their dead brethren to the attack again. As she had since the first half-dozen rats had been dropped on them, Bridget dug her fingers into the moist wall of the pit and broke off a fist-sized clod. She hurled it with all her strength at a brown and white spotted rodent, catching it full on its pointed snout. It twisted over backward on its hind legs and lay writhing with a broken neck. DeFore broke the back of the rat between her hands over her knee and hurled its corpse among the survivors. The rats continued to circle them, dodging the thrown clods of earth. Above them, Bridget heard the scuff and scutter of feet. She couldn't look up, as the rats wouldn't permit any distraction. A second later, she felt warm liquid sprinkle her bare back and shoulders. She thought at first the Swampy was urinating down into the pit. Then she saw a speckling of blood on her upper arms. An instant later, a round object plunged down from above and landed among the rats. It rolled briefly, and both women bit back cries of horror. It was the head of a Swampy, the one Okajnik had called Le Grand.
Hurry up! I had to kill him! He wouldn't let me bring you up!
The rats, first frightened by the arrival of Legrand's head, became enthralled by the blood oozing from the ragged stump of his neck. They paid no attention as the women scrambled to their feet. Doyle lay on his stomach at the edge of the hole, arms outstretched.
Hurry!
You go first, Reba.
No, not her! She's been kissed. She's one of the beasts. Leave her to the rats. She's immune to the plague now.
Both of us or neither of us?
Doyle hesitated, raised his head to glance around, then nodded.
All right, just hurry.
Making a stirrup with her linked hands, Bridget heaved DeFore up into the arms of Doyle, who lifted her out of the pit. She heard a scrabbling behind her and saw several rats crawling over Legrand's head, creeping toward her feet. She gathered herself and leaped straight up, clasping Doyle's forearms. Straining, he swung her up and out. They crouched down in wedges of shadow, seeing no Swampies nearby except for the headless body of Legrand. With the blood-smeared machete in his hand, Doyle pointed to their bodysuits, which lay wadded on the ground.
I've brought your clothes. What's left of them?
The two women quickly donned them, finding them not impossibly torn, though the sleeves were rent. Chafed by the fabric, the scratches inflicted by the rat's claws began to pain Bridget.
If you want to live, we'll have to get you out of here.
How?
Not you! You've been kissed. You're a beast now.
Bridget realized Doyle was mad, not raving yet, but insane nevertheless, so she approached him quietly and reasonably, trying to appeal to the shred of rationality choked by the clouds of dementia.
She's not marked, is she?
No.
Then she's not a beast, is she?
No, I suppose not.
All right, then. Are there any weapons we can use?
He shook his head slowly, waggling the machete.
Only this, which I took from Le Grand.
Give it to Reba.
As Doyle passed it over to her, DeFore frowned thoughtfully at him.
How do we get out of here? By the stream?
No, it's too well guarded. If there's retaliation from the Mudong congregation, it'll come from there. You'll have to go through the bayou.
Bridget and DeFore exchanged fearful glances. The torn bodysuits were not suited to braving the swamps. The boot socks weren't fitted to that kind of walking either.
Let's go!
He walked ahead, carelessly, with assurance, and DeFore and Bridget made no sound as they followed him through the camp. At its edge, he led them down a barely defined path. Briars snagged at their clothing and scratched at their hands. Bridget had to fight to keep from plunging desperately forward at a mad run that would have exhausted her within minutes. Doyle stopped so suddenly, DeFore nearly trod on his heels. He looked this way and that.
Let me think. Which way?
There was no warning at all, not even a rustle of foliage, but suddenly the shadows ahead of them were crowded with the short, squat figures of swampies. DeFore and Bridget whirled to retreat, but that way was blocked as well, not just by swampies, but by Okajnik. He smiled, folding his arms over his chest.
A rebellious beast must be disciplined. Doyle, you will go into the pit. The women shall be defiled. If they survive, they'll bear my mark.
Bridget knotted her fists, her jaw set rigidly. Resisting would only bring on her death, or as if she submitted, there might be another chance later. She locked her teeth, refusing to groan in despair. When a swampy reached for her, she didn't struggle. If Bridget surrendered philosophically, DeFore did not. She raced toward the line of swampies around Okajnik. They parted before her and seized her from behind, forcing her to the ground. She slashed with the machete and hamstrung a swampy so that he dropped to one knee. She took another swampy in the groin with a sideways swipe of the blade, and he pitched to the ground, hands clasped over his crotch, blood squirting between his fingers. The swampies furiously hurled themselves upon DeFore, wresting the machete from her hand. Her own teeth bared, Bridget threw herself upon them. The hand-to-hand fight was brief. Twist, gouge, kick, and punch. The swamp muties seized her arms and legs, yanked her head back by her hair. A man approached her with a bloody machete in his hand. With a gloating smirk, he moved its blade suggestively toward Bridget's throat. Its wet edge touched the side of her neck. All the swampies, even Okajnik, reacted with surprise, eyes widening, heads turning in the direction of the sound. Everyone froze, silent, in attitudes of listening for a long moment. All except Bridget. Bridget knew the unmistakable report of a sin-eater when she heard one.
You're in for it now, bitches!
The dugout canoe rounded the bend. The stream, wide and swift at that point, foamed brown at the boat's prow. The water was black, with wavering white shadows cast by the waning moon. Above the tree line in the eastern sky glowed the faintest salmon-pink sunrise. Kane looked at the glimmer as he slid his paddle in and out of the water, in tandem with the other four men in the little craft. He had almost convinced himself he had somehow returned to the days of the sky dark, the eternal night. Mama Esther, sitting forward in the boat, glanced at Kane. She was dressed in the same clothes as when Kane and Grant first saw her. The only addition to the ensemble was a large leather bag slung over her right shoulder. He paused in his paddling to glance over his shoulder downstream and saw the second of three canoes loaded with the Hungan's heavily armed Hunsi. Ammunition glittered dully in crossed bandoliers, and light glinted from long blades. Somewhere in the bayou, paralleling their course, another contingent of the Mudong warriors approached Okajnik's camp on horseback. Counting himself and Kane, Grant figured there were at least 30 people closing in on the muties, by land and by water. Mama Esther couldn't provide an accurate estimate of the opposition. She doubted the swampies numbered more than 50, particularly after the casualties they had sustained in the battles during the night. The odds were unfavorable enough, despite the swampies' primitive weapons, and Okajnik was the most formidable X-factor. Esther suddenly stiffened.
Bultu!
Her people obediently rowed toward the right-hand bank, drifting into tall reeds and bulrushes. Wordlessly, she pointed ahead. Kane and Grant leaned forward, peering in the direction of her finger. About 30 yards away, they could just make out a sagging dock stretching over the stream. They also glimpsed three squat-bodied swampies right at the water's edge.
It is as I feared. They stand watch for us.
Kane glared, fanning away gnats from his eyes.
They're standing sentry for an attack force, right?
Oui.
What if they don't see a force, but only one man?
Grant and the woman whipped their heads toward him, startled.
As vicious as they are, and they are maybe so drunk too, they go after him themselves. It would be sport.
That's what I figure.
Swiftly, he unbuckled his sin-eater from his forearm and removed his thick-soled boots. He whipped his combat knife from the web belt scabbard.
What are you planning?
The old distract-and-conquer strategy. I'll let them see me splashing around. If they come after me, the rest of you can creep up and land the boats.
What if they catch your ass? Or worse, instead of coming after you in the water, they just run back to the camp to let everybody know there's a suicidal idiot in the stream.
We won't be much worse off than we are now. We can't go ashore without them spotting us anyhow, right? Besides, I'm counting on you to cover my ass so they can't catch it.
Placing his combat knife between his teeth, Kane slid his legs over the side of the canoe, brought his index finger to his nose, and snapped it away in a sharp salute. Gravely, Grant returned it. It was a gesture the two men had developed during their mag days, and reserved for undertakings with a 1% chance of success. There was scarcely a splash to mark his smooth entrance into the stream. Ripples spread quietly, but Kane's head didn't break the surface again. Underwater, he stroked for the darkness beneath the dock. When he rose, it was with his hands against the slime-coated base of a piling. He lifted his head and peered through the shadows. Kane made out the figures of the swampies on the bank. He submerged noiselessly, then swam toward them. He took the knife from between his teeth, and his head broke the surface. The swampies gaped at him in commingled shock and disbelief. One of them drew a blade from his ragged clothing and bounded into the stream. He vanished beneath the water. Gripping his knife, Kane dove. There was no visibility under the black surface, but Kane had marked the swampy's course, and his knife groped for him. The point touched living flesh and felt it flinch away. He stroked forward, at the same time lunging with his knife as if it were a sword. He thrust the knife at an upward angle through the underside of the mutie's jaw. Wrenching the blade free, he struck twice more, then swept backward and up to the surface. Instantly, the other two swampies took to the water, swimming toward Kane, trying to encircle him. Kane stroked away swiftly, but a round head broke the water within a yard of him. He flung himself toward it, his knife flashing in a decapitating swing. The head flinched back out of range and instantly disappeared, but not before Kane glimpsed a knife between its teeth, a knife that would now be seeking his groin. It was useless to try to back kick out of range. The swampy had the speed of a dive behind him, so Kane did the only thing possible. He plunged forward and to one side at the same time. He had an impression of two other swampies moving toward him. Then he whirled to strike at the closest man. The mutie's knife broke water first, thrusting toward the spot where a moment before Kane had been. Kane didn't wait for the whole man to show. He dove with the knife aimed directly for the body behind that arm. He felt the blade sink home, halfway to the hilt. He did not attempt a second stroke, but floundered on past the man, dragging his knife with him. There was no telling where the knife had struck, but he knew he hadn't inflicted a fatal wound. Stroking cautiously beneath the water, knife hand feeling ahead for obstructions, he touched the splintery surface of a piling, circled it, and allowed himself to drift. Behind the post, he waited, listening. He didn't push out into the open. Probably the two or three swampies were doing as he did, treading water and waiting for their enemy to betray his position. He began to swim with small splashings, deliberately making noise. Behind him, all was silence. He swam on, not too swiftly. When he had gone 20 yards from the edge of the wharf, he peered behind him. With the speed of fish, two swampies were swimming after him. Kane began to flounder as if fatigued. The knives in the mouths of his pursuers were visible, glints of silver in the fading moonlight. From the bank, Grant's Sin Eater spit red flame. One of the heads broke apart, then vanished. Kane spun about and sped toward the remaining swampy. The man paused uncertainly, turned, and began to swim back toward the wharf, but at a pace that was markedly slow and burdened. Kane swam after him with a powerful overhand. He heard the concussion of Grant's second Sin Eater shot and turned to find another swampy frothing the water in a death flurry, a fist-sized cavity in the rear of his head. Kane stroked for the bank, and when he reached the shallows, he turned and waved his knife over his head. As he did so, he heard in the distance the cawing crow of a rooster, then a crash of blaster fire. As Bridget's laugh turned into a fierce smile, she heard another shot followed by an eerie silence. Okajnik glared about and gestured forcefully. The swampies began to mill back toward the camp, dragging her and DeFore with them. The silence was suddenly broken by the crowing of a rooster from somewhere in the bayou, but very close. Okajnik visibly blanched and pushed his way roughly through the confused swampies, shoving them out of his way. They reached for him. He slapped their hands away. The volley of gunfire ripping from the underbrush was not what the swampies or their master expected. The muties panicked, slapping at their bodies where bullets struck them. The swampy who menaced Bridget with the machete clawed at the base of his spine. She watched the man drop the weapon and fall, kicking in agony. Within a second of the fusillade, the swampies swarmed like a colony of terrified ants. They raced blindly back toward their camp, bowling Bridget, Doyle, and DeFore off their feet. With a pounding of hooves, a line of horsemen appeared, crashing through the underbrush and firing rifles as they rode. They swept in like a flesh and muscle tidal wave, flame and noise spouting from the bores of lever-action Winchesters. They thundered past and around Doyle, DeFore, and Bridget, who scrambled out of their path. The horsemen gave the three people swift, gleam-eyed, appraising glances. One of the mounted men, like a casual afterthought, pointed his rifle at Doyle and squeezed the trigger. The bullet turned his scarred face into a red jelly smear, spinning him around on his heels and dropping him heavily into the brush. Bridget and DeFore crawled swiftly over to him, turning him over. Despite the round that had cored a path through his head, the man's eyes were open and blinking. He struggled to speak.
They saw only the beast, and they killed it. Now it's me again. It is me.
His eyes remained open, but life eased out of them, leaving them empty and blank. DeFore sank her teeth into her underlip and gently closed Doyle's eyes.
Maybe what happened to him should happen to me!
Bridget didn't reply, turning her head in the direction of the camp. Gunshots and hoofbeats continued to resound, intermixed with gobbling shrieks of fear and pain. She listened carefully, then heard familiar, cracking reports. She pulled DeFore to her feet.
It's Kane and Grant. They're here.
How do you know?
Taking her by the hand, Bridget led her stumbling through the brush.
Two Sin Eaters! It has to be!
Releasing DeFore, Bridget sprinted forward, heart pumping fearfully. When she reached the edge of the camp, she had no choice but to stagger to a halt or be trampled. Figures were locked in a mass of combat, spilling and falling to the ground beneath the impacts of bullets and crossbow bolts. Riderless horses and people ran this way and that in disorganized clusters of terror and fury. A man fell off his horse, clutching his hands to his upper body where a feathered shaft sprouted. Carefully, moving in a crouch, Bridget saw two scar-faced men standing head and shoulders above the milling swampies. They fired full-auto bursts from big-bored hand blasters at a pair of horsemen. The barrage smashed into the animals, knocking them onto their hind legs with heart-rending screams. The hand blasters were Sin Eaters, but the men weren't dressed as mags. They bore the same motley, mismatched collection of ragged clothes as the muties. But at each of their shots, a man either plunged from the back of a horse or the animal shrieked, reared, and crashed to the ground. Bridget stared in dumbfounded shock. She hadn't just assumed Kane and Grant had arrived to rescue them. She had believed it with an almost religious faith. She was still staring when the swampy woman attacked her, lunging viciously with a straight-arm thrust. A long knife like a thorn of steel gleamed in her fist. She reeled back and threw herself sideways to escape, dodging a slash with the blade. She rolled, kicked the woman in the back of the knee, and knocked her leg out from under her. As the swampy tried to catch herself, she dropped her knife. Scooping it up, Bridget stabbed for the woman's throat and missed, but the blade took her in the shoulder. Still, she scuttled away. Bridget wasted no more time on her. Her anger was as cold as an Arctic night and as black. Head down, she rushed the men with the Sin Eaters. They were so occupied squeezing off one shot after another, they didn't see her until she was nearly beside them. One man swung his head toward her, a shaved sliver of a second before she stabbed him through the heart, holding the knife point upward. The other man whirled toward her, leading with his blaster. A subgun chattered in a short burst. The beast spun around on his toes, the top of his skull floating away in a red mist. Bridget pivoted at the waist. A soaking wet and ragged Kane marched toward her, his own Sin Eater in hand. All the strength seemed to seep out of Bridget's body through the soles of her feet, and she sank to her knees.
Baptiste!
Only when she felt his hand close around her wrist and haul her to her feet did she even acknowledge he was there. She tried to fight her way out of his grasp. Worry chilled Kane's guts when he got a good look at her. Bridget's face was corpse-like. Her flesh, where it wasn't covered in filth, was pale as if drained of blood. Her green eyes were dry and bright. She smiled at him, but it was flat and mocking, with an edge of despair.
Is it you, or a beast?
Kane released her, merely backing away from the madness in Bridget's eyes, from the fever harshness in her laughter.
It's me, Baptiste. Brent's here too. Where's DeFore?
She gestured negligently over his shoulder.
Somewhere.
Somewhere where?
Bridget crouched beside the man she had heart-stabbed, holding his hand between her own. Behind her, he saw Grant and Mama Esther rushing toward them, leading a charge of the Hunzi. A rush of swampies surged to meet them, grappling hand-to-hand. Kane had his Sin Eater set on Triburst. He chopped down three of the closest muties, sending them flopping to the ground, spurting blood and bone from devastating head wounds. The Swampies fought with a desperate savagery that surprised even Cain. Fingers gouged out eyeballs. Necks were broken between immensely strong hands. They exposed themselves to blaster fire as if they didn't know or care what death was. The Swampies courted death to deal death. Back and forth the struggle rolled, blaster fire crashing, humans and muties howling. Feet churned the ground to crimson-tinted sludge. The dead, the wounded, the mutilated were stamped underfoot. The kill zone was packed and jammed with Swampies and Hunzi, combatants crushed together, breast to breast. The Hunzi were outnumbered, but the effect of their blasters was devastating. The end of the battle was not sudden, but more of a gradual decline, with fewer and fewer shots being fired as the Swampies retreated into the foliage. The Hunzi started to pursue them, but Mama Esther, shouldering her big blunderbuss, threw up a hand.
Stop!
Some of her people obeyed, breaking off the pursuit. Others, caught up in blood fever, paid no attention and ran to the edge of the swamp. Then Okajnik was among them. He was a whirlwind, plunging his claws between ribs, ripping hearts from chests amid sprays of blood and viscera.
Get back! It is him! It is Okajnik!
Grant and Cain stared, shocked into momentary paralysis by the handsome, dark-haired man marching toward them, killing and mutilating as he came. They brought his figure into target acquisition and fired all the remaining rounds in their cinders. They saw him react to the impact of the bullets, which turned him this way and that, and brought forth small twitches of his smiling lips, but he remained on his feet. Esther stepped forward, planting the butt of the blunderbuss against her shoulder, bringing it into firing position. Okajnik's yellow-green eyes flared at her. His pace slowed, but he didn't come to a full halt. She thumbed back the lock.
Kanja woman, thou and thy fetishes and charms cannot slay me. Dost thou truly think that toy will do thee any good against a god?
You are no good. You are a leftover from a time gone by.
Point that toy at me, and I will tear thy tongue from thy head and eat it before thine eyes.
Fuck you.
A glob of white granules, looking almost like a fist-sized snowball, catapulted from the flared boar and struck Okajnik dead center, bursting in a fine mist of powdery particles. He didn't fall or bleed or even stagger. Instead, he thrashed and beat himself as if he believed he had caught fire and was trying to smother the flames. His flesh peeled, blistered, and erupted in pustules. They burst like punctured balloons, squirting a thick, foul-smelling, mucus-like substance. Okajnik clawed at himself, his mouth spreading wide and spewing more of the heavy liquid. His long tongue lashed back and forth like the tail of a lizard in its death throes.
What the hell?
I loaded it with purified salt, just like I told you. And now for the silver.
She dropped the blunderbuss and plucked from between her breasts the cross of St. John. She held it high in her left hand and approached the hissing Okajnik, who crouched and watched her approach with wide, staring eyes. All of his human features faded, falling away like a snake shedding its skin. Esther had taken only a few steps when Grant and Cain heard a meaty thud. Mama Esther stumbled and fell to her knees, her right hand pressing against her chest, just below her left breast. A feathered shaft jutted out between her splayed fingers. She kept her hand there as she eased into a sitting position, as if she were trying to catch the pain. Okajnik started to straighten up. Then Defore was behind him, whipping the machete in her hands up across the rear of Okajnik's neck. Outraged, he whirled, long, talon-tipped fingers clawing for her in wild sweeps, but she paid no attention. She chopped at him with the blade, holding it in a double-fisted grip as if it were a battle axe. The edge sank deep into his oozing belly and withdrew trailing slime.
This is me! This is me, you perverted son of a bitch!
Pink foam bubbled out from Okajnik's lips, and he reached for her again. Cain and Grant started to lunge forward, but Brigid Baptiste pushed between them, elbowing them aside. She snatched up the crucifix from Mama Esther's slack fingers and dashed directly at Okajnik.
Baptiste, no!
Clumsily, Okajnik shambled around to face her. Brigid left the ground in a long dive as if she intended to tackle him. A sweep of black-clawed fingers sliced open the back of her bodysuit, but she shoved the tiny cross between the leaking lips in Okajnik's belly, then hit the ground, tucked, and rolled. From Okajnik's body shot a single shaft of white light, unbearably bright. He reeled and staggered, tearing at his belly, ripping out clots of tissue. He shriveled, and then flames roared out of him and around him. His clothes and skin exploded with a blinding, crackling flare. Okashnik ran, frenzied, a flaming human-shaped torch, every inch of his body spewing fire. His body imploded in a burst of blue and white flames. All that was left was a blackened streak of carbonized ash that gave off a few sputtering sparks. Kane and Grant and all the people watching had no true concept of what they had just witnessed, but all of them felt a surge of relief so great it made them weak. Numbly, Grant kneeled beside Mama Esther, wincing at how deeply the arrow was embedded in her chest. Her lips stretched in a grimacing smile.
Nothing you can do for me now, Ivan de Loa. Don't expect you to fight a devil out of hell and come out with a whole skin. I knew there was a price to pay, and my vision was a true one. You travel by lightning, by thunder, to the magic of this storm.
Mama Esther closed her eyes and died with a smile still on her lips. Hurunsi waved Grant back, and, stone-faced, they claimed her body, carrying it away toward the river. Kane turned toward Brigid and Defore, who stood motionless, staring at him without really seeing him.
Whatever was going on here, I suppose it's over.
Neither of the women replied, or even acted as if they heard him. They looked toward the eastern sky, at the rising sun. It rose, swimming in cloud shadows, the color of blood.
At least the sun finally came up.
Is that supposed to mean something good?
Taking Defore by the arm, Brigid walked slowly after the Hunzi. Kane looked toward the lurid red sky, desperately seeking an unshadowed sun. Outlander's Shadow Scourge is a graphic audio production. Outlanders and all characters are trademarks owned by Harlequin Enterprises Limited, used by others under license. Copyright 2000, Worldwide Library. Production copyright 2008, The Cutting Corporation, all rights reserved. Performed by Terence Azel Ford, Nanette Savard, Thomas Penny, Richard Rowan, James Konacek, Dolores King-Williams, Ken Jackson, David Coyne, James Lewis, Eric Messner, Andy Clements, M.B. Van Dorn, and Mort Shelby. Additional red shirts by The Dead Giveaways. Script adaptation by Cheryl Hayes. Directed by Terence Azel Ford. Produced by Rick Rowan and Dwayne Beeman. Executive producers James Cutting, Mary Cutting, and Angie Cornett. Dialogue editing and graphic audio sound design by Brian Patton. The Outlander's theme was composed by Norman Vandersleis. Additional original music by Nathaniel Perry, Chris Rowan, Dan Smith, and Brian Patton. If you enjoyed Outlanders, be sure to look for James Axler's Deathlands, available at road stops everywhere at 1-800-670-5220 or at www.graphicaudio.net, where you'll find samples of all our Action Pump titles, as well as free screensavers, desktops, ringtones, and games. Keep listening for another episode of Mark Dalton, Owner Operator.
Graphic Audio presents Mark Dalton, Owner Operator. Book number 2, Reefer Madness and More Tales of the Open Road by Ido Van Belkom. Copyright 2008, Ido Van Belkom. Performed by David Coyne and the Graphic Audio Players. Episode number 3, Down in the Dumps.
Mark had tried to clean up the inside of Motherlode after it had been stolen and recovered, but it was one of those jobs that required the services of a professional. The candy wrappers laying around the cab were easy enough to pick up, but the chocolate that was ground into the carpet was going to need some heavy-duty shampooing to come clean. And then there was the ever-present smell of urine. He still couldn't believe it. How could a driver take a leak inside the cab? Even damned cats knew not to shit and eat in the same place. But grumbling over the state of his truck wasn't going to get it any cleaner. He needed someone with the proper tools and equipment to give his truck a good scrub, inside and out. A quick check of his insurance policy informed Mark that he was allowed to claim an amount in restorative costs following any theft or vandalism. Of course, just because his insurance company said it would cover the cost of cleanup, that didn't necessarily mean Mark would want to put it in a claim. He'd heard insurance companies described in plenty of ways, but the description he liked best was that insurance companies would loan you an umbrella on a sunny day, but would ask for it back the moment it started raining. He needed to have his truck clean, no doubt about that, but he'd decide what to do about the claim after the work was done, depending on the total charge. After sitting down to a hot cup of coffee and a Boston cream donut, Mark picked up a copy of the Toronto phone book and looked under auto detailing for a nearby shop. There was nothing in the phone book that set one place apart from another, so he picked one with a catchy name that wasn't too far from his present location. Sweet and Cherry, probably two hard-working young guys who took real pride in their work. That was the place for him. Mark finished his donut, gulped down the last of his coffee, and grabbed a newspaper from one of the tables on his way out of the shop. Mark got into his truck and laid the newspaper down on the seat. It stunk like piss, and his hands stuck to everything he touched. After rolling the window down for some fresh air, he started up the truck and hurried out of the lot headed for Sweet and Cherry. Just thinking about the place made his truck smell better. Sweet and Cherry was located on Dufferin Avenue, just north of Wilson, in behind a gas station on the northeast corner of the intersection. There were more than a dozen cars parked in the lot in front of the shop, SUVs mostly, but also a healthy assortment of other makes like Mercedes-Benz, BMW, Hummer, Lexus, and Jaguar. There were even a few big old Cadillacs thrown in for good measure. All of them were immaculately clean.
Oh yeah, these guys are good.
Mark pulled into the lot, slowing the truck down to a crawl in order not to hit any of the other cars on the side of him. Mark turned and started walking toward the shop, only to find four people standing outside the front door of the place, staring at him.
What's their problem?
Mark turned around to see if there was some sight to behold directly behind him, but there was only Motherlode.
Whoa, it's a truck.
No, it's not just a truck, it's a Peterbilt. Best of all, it's bought and paid for.
It's a big truck.
Oh yeah, it's a big truck all right. It's dirty too, inside and out, and that's why I'm here.
A young blonde-haired man stepped forward. His hair was pulled back in a ponytail, giving Mark an unobstructed view of the four earrings in his left ear. Two on the bottom, two on the top. There were Doc Martens on his feet, and the cuffs at the bottom of his chinos were pressed to a knife's edge. He had a sweater on that sported the words, "The Nylons," over his heart, and since there were four microphones under the words, Mark assumed it had something to do with the singing group. The man looked over at Motherlode, and then back at Mark, lowering his head so he was looking at Mark over the top of his thick-rimmed granny glasses.
You want us to clean your truck?
It is what you do here, isn't it?
We clean cars here. Expensive cars. We don't do trucks.
Why not?
Because they're dirty.
Cars get dirty too, don't they?
Not these cars.
Why not?
Their owners usually wash them before they bring them to us. After that, we make them shine.
Mark thought about taking Motherlode elsewhere, but there was just something about this guy's attitude that convinced Mark he was going to get his truck cleaned by Sweet and Cherry, no matter what. He looked over his shoulder at Motherlode.
So give it a wash before you make it shine.
We're pretty expensive.
You think I don't have money, you little prick? Just because I drive a truck for a living?
Whoa, man, hey. I was just trying to warn
you. You clean my goddamn truck and make it shine like a brand new penny, and I'm not gonna take any more shit. I want the best you've got, and I don't care how much it costs. She deserves the best. And if she doesn't get it, I'm gonna take it out on your ass.
Sure, man. Whatever you want.
Well, all right then.
Mark still wanted to be angry, but the guy's compliance had stolen all of his thunder.
Come with me and we'll make up a work order.
Mark nodded, then followed the guy to the office.
What's your name, by the way?
Thatch. Thatch Waverly.
Nice name.
It took Thatch Waverly about 20 minutes to go down the list of options available, which ranged from the brand of chrome polish Mark preferred to the scent he would like for the interior of the vehicle. Mark wanted to ask what all this was going to cost him, but he'd already put his foot in his mouth by saying he didn't care how much it cost. So instead, he explained about Motherlode being stolen.
Do you guys bill insurance companies?
Nah, too much hassle. We bill you and you figure it out with your insurer.
Oh, okay.
Mark was starting to get a bad feeling in the pit of his stomach.
Now, we won't be able to finish the job today, so there'll be no charge for leaving your truck with us tonight. But if you can't pick it up by the end of business tomorrow, we'll charge you for the second night stay. Is that all right?
Mark smiled, wondering if he were leaving Motherlode in a detailing shop or a five-star hotel. Charging him to keep his truck parked in their lot seemed strange, but Mark figured there wouldn't be any reason why he couldn't pick up the truck tomorrow afternoon. Besides, this place was basically just a glorified car wash. How much could go wrong in a day? After dropping off Motherlode at Sweet and Cherry, Mark decided to call his dispatcher, Bud, and let him know he'd be out of action for the next 2 days. Hopefully, Bud would have a load for him by the end of the week, and Mark would be able to get a clean start with a fresh new Motherlode.
Yellow.
Hi, Bud, this is Mark.
Mark who?
Marco Polo, you damn Muppet. I'm the new Irish driver you hired on last week.
Dalton?
Yeah. My rig's getting cleaned and detailed today and tomorrow, so I'm looking for a load toward the end of the week.
Detail? What do you mean, clean with little brushes?
I guess so.
Those places charge a fortune.
Mark knew the services at Sweet and Cherry would be expensive, but as long as his insurance company would be taking care of it, Mark hadn't been all that worried.
Insurance should cover it.
Yeah, but there's usually a limit to the amount you can claim for something like that. There'll probably be a pretty stiff deductible amount, too.
Suddenly, Mark could see this little episode costing him dearly, but he wasn't about to admit as much to Bud.
Whatever it costs, it'll be worth it to have her back shiny, clean, and good as new.
Yeah, right. If you think so.
So, will you have something for me the day after tomorrow?
Nothing right now, but I'll see what I can do. Oh, whoa, wait a minute. What are you doing the rest of today and tomorrow?
Reading books and watching TV, I guess. Why?
I know a guy in town who owns a few dump trucks. He's always looking for short-term drivers.
I don't know anything about dump trucks.
Oh, what's there to know? Box goes up, box goes down. Besides, this guy usually pays in cash at the end of the day, which might come in handy when you go to get your truck back.
Mark figured Bud was right. Cash was always a good thing, and it would be smart to be ready for the bill when it came.
Okay, sure. I'll give it a try.
The guy's name was Boris Bordensky, and he seemed happy to hear from Mark.
When can you start work?
When Mark said he could start work right away, Boris gave him the address of his yard and told Mark to hop in a cab.
I even pay, okay?
And so Mark called a cab and went to the B.B. Haulage yard in the Albion Road and Highway 50 in northeast Toronto.
You drive truck long time?
Boris and Mark headed out into the yard, toward a line of trucks that had long since seen their prime.
I've been driving for years, but never dump trucks.
That's okay. You have license, right?
Yeah.
That is okay. This truck for you.
It was a Mack dumper, that was obvious. But since their distinctive cab style had changed so little over the years, Mark couldn't be sure how old the truck was. It could be 5 years old, it could be 10. After he started up the truck, which Mark was happy to hear ran like a charm, Boris gave Mark a crash course on dump truck operation.
Here's controls.
Boris pointed to a big red lever.
This make box go up. This make box go down.
In a quick 20-minute talk, Boris told Mark everything he'd need to know about driving a dump truck.
And very important to clean box after every time you dump because you don't always know what load coming next.
Right.
And don't waste time between picking up and dumping because it's very cold now and material in box can freeze.
Right.
Any questions?
What about...
Okay, then. Here's first pickup. Go here and pick up. Then go here and dump, okay?
Yeah, okay, I guess.
Good, see you tonight. I pay you then, okay?
Right, okay.
Okay, bye.
What the hell have I gotten myself into?
Mark's first load was demolition debris from an apartment renovation in downtown Toronto. When he arrived at the site, he was second in line behind another BB dump truck, this one looking even more run down than Mark's. It took about 15 minutes for Mark's turn to come. From the looks of the stuff they were loading into the trucks, someone had done a to-the-girders gutting of the apartment building. There was all sorts of drywall, broken wood, flooring, windows, and carpeting strewn about the parking lot. A heavy-duty front-end loader was scooping up the debris and dumping it into the trucks. When the first load fell into the box, Mark nearly went deaf from the sound of the wood and stone falling on steel. He was also amazed by how much the truck bounced around while it was being loaded.
No wonder these damn trucks look like they've been through the ringer. They have.
Out on the street, Mark checked his map and saw that Boris wanted the load dumped on some rural property south of Newmarket, just off Highway 404. Mark wasn't aware of any dumps in the area, but he suspected Boris had found a few landowners looking for clean fill. Mark reached the site a couple of hours later and was happy to see that the dump site was clearly marked and had obviously been in use for some months by several different companies.
There's an orange flag at the end of this road. Back your truck up to the flag and dump your load over the side.
Seems easy enough.
But when Mark got to the end of the road, he discovered that he'd passed the orange flag. Not wanting to go all the way around again, he decided to reverse the truck back to the flag. When the orange flag showed up in his mirrors, he swung the rear of the truck around to the right and backed the truck up to the line marked by the flag. Then, when he was in place, he took a look overhead for any wires. There were none, and started raising the box. As the box began to rise, Mark noted that one side of the truck seemed lower than the other.
What the hell? A flat?
The material in the box began to slide out the back gate. A little at first, but then more and more. Then nothing.
What's going on?
And then the truck began to move, not forward or backward, but sideways.
Get out of there! Get out of there!
Mark looked to his left and saw the site manager running toward him. Mark put the truck in gear and started forward, the box finally coming to rest on the truck's chassis. The site manager climbed up on the side of Mark's truck.
What the hell do you think you're doing?
Dumping my load?
You're on the wrong side of the flag. This side's uneven and unstable. You're lucky you didn't roll your truck, especially with half your load frozen inside the box.
Oh, is that what happened?
Jesus Christ! Break up the load and try it again on this side of the flag this time.
Right.
After getting in line behind a Western Star trailing a pup, Mark read a copy of the truck news while he inched his way forward into the loading area. When his turn came, he gave the loader the order form Boris had given him that morning and parked his truck in position to receive the load. Moments later, the gravel was dumped into the back of the truck. The loader said something to Mark and then gave him a wave, but Mark hadn't heard a word the man said. The dump truck was hard to maneuver, but as long as he took his time, gave himself plenty of room to brake, and didn't try any quick or sharp turns, he'd be fine. When he reached the building site in Richmond Hill, Mark learned that the gravel was for the floor in a large new industrial complex just off Yonge Street, north of Major Mackenzie Drive. The construction foreman stopped him as he entered the site.
Who are you working for?
Boris, BB.
Jesus, it's like he's got a new driver every day.
This is my second day.
Yeah, whatever. Find Unit 26. There's a dump man there who'll guide you in.
Mark circled around the building, having a hell of a time finding his way through the stacks of bricks and 2x4s laying all over the site place. Not to mention cars and trucks parked anywhere there was an empty spot. Finally, he reached Unit 26. The dump man signaled for Mark to start backing in, and Mark shifted into reverse. He followed the dump man's signal and backed into the unit, moving toward a large bare spot on the floor.
Hey! Hey! Whoa!
Mark took a look in his mirror. The dump man had his hands out, pushing them in the air in Mark's direction, as if he might be able to slow down the truck with just a gesture. Mark slammed on the brakes.
What the hell do you think you're doing, hoser?
Sorry!
Mark got rid of his load and got off site as quickly and as carefully as he could. Mark's second load of gravel was destined for a new home being built in an old established neighborhood in Oakville. Finding the house was tricky, especially since many of the suburban streets had signs prohibiting heavy trucks, but he eventually found it. The foreman instructed Mark to back the truck up into the driveway and to follow his signal to know where to dump the load. After the miscue in the morning, Mark wasn't about to take his eye off the foreman.
Okay, that's far enough. Let her go.
Mark raised the box, proud of himself for following the foreman's instructions and putting the load in precisely the right place.
Stop! Shut it off! Don't move!
What now?
Shut it off and don't move!
The foreman was walking oddly up the side of the truck.
What?
The man pointed skyward. When Mark stuck his head out the window for a look, the first thing he noticed were the sparks. White and blue flashes of light jumped and danced from the tip of the box to the overhead wires it had come in contact with.
Oh, shit!
Mark quickly grabbed the lever to try and lower the box. But instead of coming down on its own, the box caught on one of the wires and snapped it, so that the broken and exposed end of the wire was now laying across the big steel box. The Big Mac shuddered and stalled. Mark wanted to try and restart it, but he knew he'd be lucky if it even turned over.
Don't get out of the truck if you want to live.
Damn.
Mark rested his head against the steering wheel. He'd never felt more foolish and embarrassed sitting behind the wheel of a truck before in his life. Hopefully, he wouldn't be here too long. 4 hours later, Mark was still sitting in the truck. The trouble was that the power grid that Mark had tapped into also fed into the local hospital. In order to free Mark, emergency workers needed to shut down the power, and a power shutdown near a hospital was something that was to be avoided at all cost. And so, Mark sat. He'd used his cell phone to call Bud and make him promise never to let him drive a dump truck again. Bud laughed and promised, then gave Mark his next load, if he got out of this present predicament before tomorrow. Next, Mark called Sweet and Cherry to explain to Thatch Waverly that he might not be able to pick up his truck before closing today.
No problem, dude. We'll keep it in the lot overnight.
Isn't there a charge for that?
Sure, but it's just $150 a night, man.
What?
That's their usual charge.
Does that include room service?
Relax, man. It's like 1% of your total bill.
That's $1,500.
About that, plus tax. A drop in the bucket for our regular customers.
Just for washing my truck?
We did more than just wash it, dude. The rig is ready for a Saturday night. Ow!
Yeah, I won't pay that much.
You signed the work order, man, so no buck, no truck.
Mark had a few other words in mind that ended in uck, but held his tongue. He'd never felt so helpless or ucked over in his life.
See you in the morning, dude.
Oh, I'm looking forward to it.
Mark wasn't freed from the fallen wires until after 6 that evening. Sweet and Cherry might have still been open, but even if he went straight there, it would have taken him over an hour at this time of day, and they'd surely be closed by then. It was time to call it a night, but Mark wasn't ready to quit for the day just yet. He needed another load, both to deliver and to execute the plan he had in mind for getting even with Thatch Waverly and the whole Sweet and Cherry setup. But first, he had to call Boris.
Sorry about the wires, Boris.
Didn't I tell you to look up for wires?
No, you told me to clean the box after every dump and not to waste time because stuff could freeze in the box.
And about wires?
Nothing.
Okay. Maybe a little my fault. Anyway, you finished with me now, no?
I wanted to talk to you about that. I was hoping you had another load for me.
You need the money, right?
That was sort of true. He would need cash to pay for the detailing job for his truck, but that was secondary to the other thing he had in mind.
Right.
You clean box?
After every dump.
Good.
Boris gave Mark another pickup and drop-off address.
Go this address for pickup, this one for delivery. Each one open 24 hours. Bring back truck in morning. I cash you out, okay?
Sure.
This time, the pickup wasn't at any gravel pit outside of town. Instead, it was a meatpacking plant in the St. Clair Avenue and Old Weston Road area. At one time, entire blocks were taken up by the Canada Packers plant and the stockyards holding their livestock. Now, even though the Canada Packers operation had been scaled down, there were still plenty of meat packaging plants in the area. Mark wasn't sure who would need a dump truck around here, but the Nightman assured him he was in the right place. When the Nightman came back dressed in a raincoat, Mark was even more confused.
What'll I be carrying?
Guts!
As if on cue, a specially designed forklift appeared at the loading dock, dumping the contents of large storage containers into the box of Mark's truck.
What is it?
Guts! Organs! Entrails! Just about everything we don't end up using for hot dogs or pet food.
Mark was both amazed and ecstatic.
So, I'll be driving away with a whole dump truck full of animal guts?
They won't fill it all the way up, but yeah, basically.
Sweet.
When he first asked Boris for another load, he'd been expecting to get a box full of gravel or sand. The load of guts had been a more than welcome surprise. Mark had planned on dumping a load of dirt on each of the cars in the Sweet and Cherry lot as a way of teaching that asshole Thatch Waverly a lesson about giving a hardworking man a break. And while dirt would have been nice, guts were like the bomb. Just the thought of Thatch Waverly cleaning beef fat out of the nooks and crannies of a Ferrari brought a smile to Mark's face. When he reached the Sweet and Cherry lot, Mark was struck by how clean and shiny Motherlode was. Her body gleamed, and her chrome shone like the sun, even under the dim glow of the streetlights surrounding the lot. They'd done a good job, no doubt about it. Maybe even too good, since they'd even scrubbed all the grease off the fifth wheel and left the metal there clean enough to eat off. But did he need his truck to be that clean? No. And was the job worth a couple $1,000s? No. And did they have to charge him $150 just to let the truck sit overnight? No. And did Mark have to be made to feel like a second-class citizen just because he drove a truck and not a high-class sports import? Absolutely not. But did whoever owned the Ferraris and Porsches in the lot deserve to get their cars smeared with animal guts just because Thatch Waverly was an asshole? No. Dumping on the cars in the lot would be punishing their owners, not Sweet and Cherry. Mark needed to think of something else. A better plan that would put all of Mark's wrath squarely on Thatch Waverly's shoulders. As a gentle breeze wafted through the open window of the truck's cab, Mark suddenly came up with a better plan. There was a saying, less is more. And while hot cars buried underneath mounds of guts would be quite a sight, he'd need much less than a load of entrails to make his point. Mark parked the truck on the street in front of Sweet and Cherry, climbed up onto the side of the box, and used a shovel to scoop a bunch of guts and drop them onto the side of the road. Then, after climbing back down, he grabbed several handfuls of guts and carefully tucked them into inconspicuous places on the underside of each of the cars in the lot. The next morning, Mark got his bill and paid it all in cash, using all of the money he'd earned driving the dump truck as well as a few dollars of his own.
So, what name do you want on the invoice?
Boris. Boris Bordensky.
Mark didn't have a problem giving the man a false name. After all, Bordensky was a shady character in his own right and deserved to catch a bit of heat of his own down the road. Later, as Mark turned to leave, Thatch sniffed at the air.
Oh, man, do you smell that?
Smell what?
I don't know, man. Something rotten.
A grin creased Mark's face.
Nope. All I can smell is sweet and cherry.
If you enjoyed this Mark Dalton adventure, be sure to check out next month's episode featured on the following action-packed titles. First Mountain Man number 9, Preacher's Peace, The Last Gunfighter number 1, The Drifter, and Eagles number 13, Thunder of Eagles.
If you can't find that hot graphic audio title you're looking for, just head to www.graphicaudio.net, where you can order it in CD or MP3 disc format. Or, the fastest and cheapest way, download that puppy and play it on any of the many devices that'll play Windows Media. And if you're on the road or just a total computer feeb, snatch up the phone and call 1-800-670-5220. That's 1-800-670-5220 or www.graphicaudio.net.